I asked, settling into our conversation. Louis sat back. He had grown handsome in his 70s. "They want to write their own vows," he said. "What do they vow?" I asked. "They tell each other what they are willing to commit to, how they agree to grow together," he said. Then he laughed. "They all take out the word obey. None of them like it." I had known Louis for 20 years. His silver hair and caring heart were dear to me. Decades as a clergyman had left their imprint, but Louis still liked to rebel as much as he loved to serve. He was doing both now, as much as he did when he was in the church. "So you marry them anyway?" I asked. "Oh, yes," he said happily. "We talk about the ceremony, we plan it, and then we do it. Each one is different, but the Holy Spirit always comes." Why do so many people write their own commitments now? A century ago, no one would have thought of that. No one would have married outside of a church or a tribe. What has changed? A century ago, there were very few new males and new females. Now there are many, and more are emerging every day. That is what has changed. The new male and the new female follow their hearts. They are not concerned with what others expect. When they bond, they make their own vows. Those vows are as important to them as the vows that the old male and the old female make, but for a very different reason. The vows of the old female and the old male help them to survive. The old female and the old male come together to create external power. They want lives that are safer and easier. The vows of the new male and the new female help them grow spiritually. The new female and the new male come together to create authentic power. They want lives that are conscious, responsible, and fulfilling. These differences make new males and new females want to be with each other. What you want most is what you think about and talk about. If you want money more than anything else, you think and talk about money. If you want a good grade more than anything, you think and talk about grades. If you want most to become aware of your feelings, you think and talk about your feelings. The new male and the new female most want to heal their obsessions, fixations, compulsions, and addictions, so these are the things they talk about. These are not the things that the old male and the old female like to talk about. When one person talks about baseball and another talks about tennis, they don't have much in common. The same thing happens when an old male talks with a new female. The old male talks about jobs, houses, and security. The new female talks about spiritual growth. The old female talks about children and families. The new male talks about spiritual growth. The new male and the new female want to look at their deepest fears. They like to find out what makes them angry or frightened. They want to heal all the parts of themselves that are not healthy, like the parts that do not care about other people and the parts that do not like themselves. They look for ways that they try to control other people or be controlled by other people. They also look for parts of themselves that feel victimized and are resentful. Old males and old females don't do these things. They are not designed to do them. They are designed to protect and provide, and to bear children and raise them. If they are married, they think that their marriage is not working when they get angry, jealous, or frightened. They don't want to rock the boat. The boat is their marriage. The new female and the new male do what farmers, millers, and bakers do. They take their grain to the mill, grind it into flour, and bake the flour into bread. The grain is their fear, their anger, shame, jealousy, and sorrow. The mill is their spiritual partnership. The bread is the harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life that they create together. The new female and the new male are partners on a journey of spiritual growth. They want to make the journey. Their love and trust keep them together. Their intuition guides them. They consult each other. They are friends. They laugh a lot. They are equals. That is what a spiritual partnership is, a partnership between equals for the purpose of spiritual growth. What about marriage? The groom was handsome. The bride was radiant. A warm alpine day completed the picture. Snow-covered mountains dominated the distance. Pine trees surrounded the guest. When the ceremony was over, the band played, and everyone ate and danced. Then a very special thing happened. The new husband looked into the eyes of his new wife. "I trust you," he said, "because I know that you love God more than you love me." Spiritual partners know that nothing is more important to them than their own spiritual growth. This is what I believe the young man was saying to his bride. If spiritual partners have to choose between their spiritual growth and what their friends expect or their families expect, they choose spiritual growth. If they have to choose between what their tribe expects or their church, they choose spiritual growth. The new husband knew that his wife would always choose her spiritual growth over everything else, including him. As long as he remains committed to his own spiritual growth, they will grow together. That is how spiritual partnership works. Spiritual growth in one partner creates the opportunity for spiritual growth in the other. Then the other has to decide whether to grow or not. Do you remember John and Carol? Carol was the wife who screamed at her husband, "You're not respecting me!" John was her husband. John didn't know that he wasn't respecting Carol. In version one, he thought they were just having a misunderstanding. They were, but he wasn't willing to look at it from Carol's point of view. Their marriage dissolved. Carol was growing. She wasn't willing to live without respect in her marriage. She wasn't willing to submit to another person's will, even her husband's. John wasn't willing to accept these changes in his wife. In version 2, John struggled to understand Carol, and their marriage was transformed. This is the special power of a spiritual partnership. What your partner challenges you to do when he or she grows spiritually is exactly what you need to do in order to grow spiritually yourself. How could John create harmony, cooperation, sharing, or reverence while he didn't respect his wife? He couldn't. Carol showed him that. She didn't need to talk about authentic power. All she needed to do was to grow spiritually, to, quote, love God more than anything else. And that is what she did. John needed to change, but not for Carol. He needed to change for himself. Carol showed him his next step. Spiritual partnership accelerates spiritual growth. In fact, the only way to grow spiritually is now through spiritual partnerships. Until you have the courage to enter into relationships of substance and depth, you cannot develop spiritually. It doesn't matter how long you meditate or pray, or how many intentions you set. Sooner or later, you have to apply what you meditated, prayed, and intended. That requires other people. When the other people are committed to growing spiritually too, then you are in a spiritual partnership. We are all beginning to want spiritual partners and to create spiritual partnerships. Shallow talk isn't enough anymore. Making money, raising children, and buying houses aren't enough. Only spiritual growth satisfies. That is because we are all becoming new males and new females. Every spiritual partnership is different. Some look like marriages. Others look like businesses. Others look like baseball teams. Spiritual partners decide what their partnerships look like. They also decide what roles they play in them. Each spiritual partner sees himself or herself as a soul first and a personality second. Each is committed to growing spiritually. Each knows that the purpose of spiritual partnership is spiritual growth. When a marriage, a business, or a baseball team becomes a spiritual partnership, there is no limit to the creativity, love, and spiritual growth that it can produce. Its future is limited only by the choices that the partners make. Marriages, businesses, and baseball teams that don't become spiritual partnerships don't have a future. How long? We're getting a divorce, Scott said. Marilyn is angry, but she knows this has to happen. I shifted the phone to my other ear. We decided this in therapy this morning. I knew them both and loved them both. There was nothing to do but listen. Scott was silent for a long time. This is tough, he said. We were both silent. This is tough, he said again. Marilyn's anger was long-term. She supported Scott when he left the bank and became an organic farmer. She supported him when he traveled to farming workshops. She loved him, and she loved their children, and she was angry. They talked about her anger. They went to therapy. They examined her childhood, her family, and their marriage. They looked at everything. When Scott left on trips, he felt her anger. When he came home, she was still angry. Years passed. Then came the divorce. Scott was a new male, and Marilyn was a new female. They were not an old male and an old female trying to understand new males and new females. They grew together spiritually, and they intended to grow together spiritually. Their marriage was a spiritual partnership, but it ended anyway. Why did that happen? It happened because they stopped growing together. Marilyn wasn't changing, and Scott was. They loved each other, but that couldn't keep them together. Scott wanted to be with Marilyn, but he wanted more to be true to himself. Marilyn wanted him to do that too, but her anger was more important to her. They did not decide to end their spiritual partnership because things got tough. All spiritual partners get into tough times. Some of those times are intense. They separated because one of them refused to grow and the other moved forward anyway. In the case of Marilyn and Scott, that took decades. This is important to understand. Spiritual partners do not exchange one another lightly. Changing spiritual partners is like changing scenery in the middle of a play. The play goes on. If you are in the 10th grade and change schools because you don't like your classmates, you will still be in the 10th grade, no matter what other school you choose. Spiritual partners know this. They expect to unearth every obstacle to intimacy between them. Those are the things they want to learn about and change. They have chosen each other to do this with. Their obstacles are not the issue. Healing them is. They are committed to doing that. There are only two things that can dissolve a spiritual partnership. Marilyn and Scott discovered one of them. Spiritual partners cannot grow together if one of them refuses to grow. When that happens, nothing can keep them together. Refusing to grow is different from having a difficult time growing. It is an intention not to grow. Sometimes people know that they are doing this. Sometimes they don't. They think to themselves that they want to grow, but they really don't. The result is always the same. No change. They don't welcome change, no matter what they say. They are stuck, and they prefer staying stuck, even in something as painful as anger. Being stuck and working to become unstuck is one thing. Being stuck and not really wanting to change that is another. The first is what spiritual partners do. The second is what dissolves their partnerships. For decades, Marilyn lived in anger. She loved it more than she loved Scott. She wanted to keep it even more than she wanted to grow spiritually. Eventually, Scott moved on. This was not emotional or sexual promiscuity. Promiscuity prevents spiritual partnership. People who are promiscuous use each other. They look at their partners as replaceable. One partner is as good as another for them. Spiritual partners don't do this. They are involved in each other's lives. They are unique to each other. They cannot be exchanged like automobile parts. This theme has a variation to it. That happens when one partner decides that she or he does not want to continue growing with the other. She knows that the same issue she has with him will resurface with another partner. She has no illusions about that. Even so, she makes the decision not to grow with her partner, and their partnership dissolves. The second reason that spiritual partnerships dissolve is very special. One of the partners completes the lessons that he or she formed the partnership to learn. This experience is unmistakable. The issues don't exist anymore. The healing is complete. No scar tissue remains, not even a trace of it. If the issue was anger, the anger is gone. If the issue was fear, inner wholeness has replaced it. The circumstances that brought the spiritual partnership into being no longer exist. The challenges change. Perceptions change. Behaviors change. Goals change. Everything changes. When that happens, the spiritual partner who completes his or her lessons no longer requires the same kind of interactions in order to grow spiritually, and the partnership changes accordingly. In other words, spiritual partners stay together as long as they grow together. When they stop growing together, their spiritual partnership dissolves. A spiritual partnership is a partnership between equals for the purpose of spiritual growth. When spiritual growth stops happening, the partnership stops happening too. Psychic archaeology. After I separated from my fiancé, I missed her terribly. I thought about her every day and every night. I thought of her while I was moving off my ranch and into a nearby town. I thought of her while I was making new friends and learning how to share my life with them. Month after month I thought about her, longed for her, and dreamed about a life with her. It didn't happen. Our plan was to live apart in order, eventually, to live together. Living apart was not new for us, but not seeing her every other month was. So was not knowing if we would stay engaged. After a year apart, she ended our engagement, and I began a journey that I never could have anticipated. "I'm not engaged anymore," I told my friends. They looked at me, patiently, but didn't say anything at first. After a while, I asked them, "What do you think about that?" I was trembling inside. Being engaged had been a big part of my identity. After a long silence, one of them said gently, "I think you're not feeling this yet." I didn't believe him at the time, but it was true. As the weeks and months passed, I discovered how true it was. Each day brought more pain, and each night was worse. Have you ever hurt yourself, but you didn't feel the pain until later, when the numbness disappeared and your hurt began to throb? That is what happened to me. I wondered if I could live through it. Every morning and evening, at every lunch and dinner, every time I thought about us, I asked myself, "How did I create this?" That became my prayer. I wanted to know that more than anything, more even than I wanted to be with my ex-fiancé again. I had felt this same pain before, with other partners. I didn't ever want to feel it again. I didn't think I could survive it if I did. I wanted this answer as if my life depended on it, and I think that it did. I got my answer, but it didn't come all at once. After several weeks, the thought of competition came to me. I called my former fiancé. "Did your decision have to do with competition?" I asked. "Yes," she said. a big yes. At last I had found something to grasp, like a thread in a tapestry. I intended to keep pulling it until the entire mystery unraveled. I tried to think of times I felt competitive with her. At first, I couldn't remember any. Then memories began to come, first a trickle, and then a flood. I was jolted. I realized that I had been jealous of her friends. I had been jealous of her business. I had been jealous of her charisma, successes, and popularity. I had been jealous of almost everything. This surprised me, but I was even more surprised to discover another layer below my competitiveness. That was control. I began to remember one time after another when I had tried to control what my fiancé was doing, or feeling, or saying. I criticized the newspaper she read. I tried to dissuade her from watching television. I tried to influence her taste in cars and clothes. I tried to impose my ideas and opinions. Remembering the many ways that I had tried to control her took several more weeks. As I remembered more and more of them, the extent of my attempts to control her became clearer and clearer to me. Then I discovered beneath my control something else: fear. By now it was winter. Snow covered the trees, and when the wind blew, everything became white with blowing snow. I lay in bed, terrified. I never imagined I could feel so frightened. I was afraid of the winter. I was afraid of the cold. I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid of everything. Fear and trembling took on new meaning. I never knew that I had fear like that in me. But when it came as an ocean. I was afraid to be alive. I thought this must be the bottom of my painful excavation, but it wasn't. Beneath my fear, I discovered yet another layer: lack of self-worth. This surprised me completely. I had won the American Book Award for the Dancing Wuli Masters. I was praised and celebrated. People wanted to hear what I had to say. But I didn't think that I had anything to say worth listening to. I couldn't imagine people liking me once they got to know who I really was. I felt there must be something wrong with anyone who was attracted to me. I couldn't find anything about me that I appreciated. Until that moment, I had thought so highly of myself. I was shocked. When I realized that I had no appreciation of myself at all of the things that I had discovered suddenly came together. Because I had no self-worth, I did not believe that I had a right to be alive. Because I didn't believe that I had a right to be alive, I was terrified of everything. Because I was terrified of everything, I needed to control everything. And my need was intense because, emotionally, it was a matter of life and death. Because my fiancé was a strong person, my attempts to control her had turned into competition. My prayer had been answered. All of the pieces of my puzzle came together, like a broken mirror, magically reassembling itself when a video of the breaking is played backward. I had asked to see how I had created my terrible nightmare. I saw. This process took months. It took 10 years more to integrate it into my life. I started immediately. I went straight to the root of the problem. I didn't work on my fear, control, or competition. I went to work on my lack of self-worth. When I got angry, but didn't speak angrily, I said to myself, "Good work." If I took 2 steps forward and slipped back 1.5, I congratulated myself. When I did something that I would have admired in others, I admired it in me. This felt awkward at first. I had no experience in doing these things. Eventually, I began to change. I discovered how to share myself with friends, to appreciate them, and to let them appreciate me. I am very grateful for all that I learned. My fiancé and I spent only 3 months together during the 2 years that we were engaged. We spent our second year living apart, trying to grow back together. I didn't know at the time why we couldn't do that, but I do now. The distance between her home on one coast and mine on the other reflected the distance inside of me that I needed to keep from her. Maybe it reflected that in her, too. Intimacy is not always comfortable. I thought that we were very intimate because we loved each other so deeply, but I didn't have the courage to be really intimate with her. I never discussed my deepest fears with her. I never told her how jealous, inadequate, and frightened I felt. She never discussed her fears with me, either. Our engagement did not end because we didn't love each other enough. We loved each other very much. But love isn't enough. It takes something else to make a spiritual partnership work. Trust. I never fell down so many times, Martha said, laughing. We don't ski in Kansas. Everyone laughed. Each time I got up, I remembered a time when I fell down and had to get up again. Sometimes I did it right away, like when I broke my hand. Other times I didn't, like when I got divorced. No one was laughing now. It was like going to graduate school about myself, she continued. I saw how I am in some situations, and how different I am in others. I also saw how I have responded the same way to some situations most of my life. Martha was changing as she spoke. Everyone there would always remember her and her healing adventure. She could have told us about how sore she was or how tired. Instead, she told us what she learned. What made the difference between an ordinary ski lesson and a life-changing day? Martha learned to recognize what was important about her experiences, and that had a big payoff for her. She saw that her insights were worth thinking about, and she thought about them. Then she asked for more insights, and more came. By the end of the day, she expected them, and they continued to come. That is why she had so much to tell us. Most people look to others to tell them what is important. They ask psychologists, priests, and gurus. They read newspapers and books. They watch television and listen to the radio. They find experts. Martha became her own expert. She didn't have to ask anyone else what her ski lesson could teach her about her divorce and the other painful experiences in her life. She saw for herself and trusted what she saw. Do you trust your experiences? When you are having an argument, do you trust that your argument is telling you something important about yourself? When you are fuming, do you trust that your rage is showing you something about yourself that you need to see? Spiritual partners do. They trust their experiences to show them important things about themselves. That is how they grow spiritually. You can't grow spiritually and stay angry, impatient, or jealous. You can't grow spiritually while you're blaming other people for what you are feeling, either. Spiritual partners look inside themselves and not at each other when they get angry, frightened, or sad. They talk about the things that frighten them to speak about. They share what they feel, but they don't blame each other for it. They trust the process. This is the process. Be aware of everything you are feeling. Look for what your emotions can show you about yourself. Share what you are feeling in a kindly way, like one student sharing an observation with another. Spiritual partners trust that they are together in order to grow together spiritually. They trust that everything that happens in their partnership helps them do that. This changes the way they see their experiences with each other, the same way that Martha's insight changed the way she saw her ski lesson. She learned something about herself each time she fell. The same thing happens in a spiritual partnership. You learn something about yourself each time you have a disagreement, and you learn more each time you work your way through one. You learn something about yourself each time you withdraw emotionally, and each time you open up again. The more you learn, the less often you become angry, withdrawn, and frightened. If you try to learn something each time you fall, it won't take you long to keep your balance on skis. If you try to learn something every time you get angry, sad, or frightened, it won't take you long to keep your balance when you start to feel angry, sad, or frightened. Some people think that disagreements are not good things, like falls when you are skiing. But spiritual partners don't look at them that way. They see disagreements as ways that friends can learn about themselves and become better friends. They look at all of their experiences that way. Part 4. How it happens. Children. Spaghetti slipped from Jamie's fork. Tomato sauce covered her mouth. At 2 1/2, she had not yet mastered the fork. She put it down and ate with her fingers. I was very happy. My daughter sat across from Linda, and I sat next to Jamie, my first granddaughter. Candlelight softened her tomato sauce face. Suddenly Jamie stopped eating and turned toward me. Her face became serious. "Be gentle," she said, looking directly at me. Her entire presence had changed. I playfully changed mine to match it, in a grandfatherly way. "Be gentle with what?" I asked her. "With yourself," she replied. Then she returned to her dinner. Suddenly she was a child playing with spaghetti again. We sat in silence. I was stunned, and so was everyone else, except Jamie. Self-severity had been a lifelong burden. Being gentle with myself was difficult for me. But how did Jamie know that? She was only 2 1/2, and besides, she had only seen me once. She knew it directly, the same way that you are beginning to know things directly. She used her intuition, although she did not know what that word meant. She just did it. She saw something about me, and she shared it. When you see something about other people, or about yourself, do you trust what you see the way Jamie did? Knowing something deep inside you is different from knowing something because other people tell you. You know what you know. You might know that it is not appropriate for you to become a doctor, for example, like your father, or go to college because your parents didn't. No one has to explain it to you. Changing inside is like that. You see things differently, and no one has to explain it to you. Your friends know that you have changed, too. You don't have the same things in common anymore. This happens to everyone. It happens to spiritual partners, too. What happens when spiritual partners change and they have children? The old male and the old female think that nothing is worse for a child than becoming separated from its parents. They see themselves, and themselves only, as responsible for the survival of their children. From their point of view, they can't help their children survive as well when they are apart as they can when they are together. Spiritual partners are also responsible for their children, but they do not experience the same difficulties when they grow apart that the old male and the old female do. Their children do not experience them either. That is because the children of spiritual partners belong to larger, loving families that do not change. These larger families are also spiritual partnerships. The children of spiritual partners grow up being cared for by everyone around them. They see more people as their aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, and grandparents than the children of old males and old females. Their families are not only biological. They are extended spiritual families. These extended spiritual families are spiritual partnerships. When the children of spiritual partners grow up, they naturally care for everyone, too. They see themselves as the aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, and grandparents of all of the children in their lives. They see everyone as their family. If you look inside yourself, you may see that you also are longing for spiritual partnerships. Millions of people are beginning to feel this longing. Soon, millions more will feel it, too. The new female and the new male create spiritual partnerships naturally. Sometimes they create them like marriages. They share a house together and have children. Sometimes they create them as businesses, or schools, or basketball teams. However they do it as equals for the purpose of spiritual growth. They become aware of what they are feeling. They learn how to make responsible choices. They strive for harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life. Then they naturally look for spiritual partners to co-create with. That is how the cycle goes. The inner work comes first, then comes spiritual partnerships. A new world is being born this way. When children are born into spiritual partnerships, they grow up in this new world. They see everyone, including themselves, as souls. They see their aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, and grandparents as souls. They see their parents that way too. This is what we are all beginning to do, to see ourselves and others as souls. This includes our children. Spiritual partners. Chris and Leslie made the room warmer just by being there. It was clear that they were in love with each other. They walked through the wide doors of the auditorium hand in hand, as they often walked together. The room began to quiet. They gracefully took their places behind the long table on the stage. To the right of Chris sat two more couples. To the left of Leslie sat another. Each person had a microphone and a glass of water. Flowers decorated the table. "Dear friends," the announcer began, "welcome to the highlight of our program." The weekend was coming to an end. The five couples had shared their experiences. Their lectures and workshops had looked at relationship from every angle. Now they came together for the last time. "We have explored the most difficult terrain in the territory of human experience," the announcer continued. "How to be with one another consciously and lovingly on one hand, and with integrity on the other. How to be a partner in a deep relationship and remain true to ourselves at the same time." Relationship workshops had become popular in the last few years, and this one had been one of the best. "There are no answers that will satisfy everyone," the announcer concluded, "but over the weekend some common themes have emerged. Respect each other. Listen to each other. Say what is difficult to say. Do not hide what is important to you. Share in the kindest way that you can. This is an opportunity to address your questions to any or all of our presenters." "I have one," said a young man on the left side of the auditorium, raising his hand. An assistant quickly brought him a microphone. "I know this sounds funny," he started, "but I still don't understand this thing called a relationship. My girlfriend says she is committed to ours, but how can I commit to a relationship when I don't even know what she means or what ours will be next month?" "You can commit to monogamy," said the woman to the left of Leslie. "In my opinion, you won't have a relationship without that. You can commit to staying together no matter what happens. The strength of a relationship lies in the knowledge that you will always be there for each other," said a man to the right of Chris. Everyone had an answer. At last, Leslie began to speak. "When I first partnered with Chris, I never realized that I was the one who had difficulties with commitment. Try as I might, I could not make a commitment to our relationship, even though we shared so much love." Leslie's voice was clear and firm. It seemed to fill the hall. "At last, I realized there was only one thing I could commit to with all my heart. That was my own growth, my spiritual growth. I also realized that Chris was the perfect partner for me to do this with, and we have been together ever since. It hasn't been easy for either of us, especially at first, but my commitment has never left me. The same is true for Chris." Chris nodded his head in agreement. "That was 15 years ago," Leslie continued. Since then, we have created a foundation, authored books, and done our best to model spiritual growth in the context of a loving, caring relationship. There are still times when I wonder if we will make it, but so far, I have grown through each of those times feeling closer to Chris than I did before. My commitment to myself, to my own growth, is the best one I ever made. It is still very much with me. I hold it in my heart every day. There were more questions and more answers, but Leslie's words hung in the air through all of them. People were still talking about them as they left the auditorium. Couples like Leslie and Chris have a special quality. They listen to each other. They laugh together. Even after 15 years, Leslie and Chris are still excited by what the other has to say. This is the way spiritual partners are when they are growing together. Chris and Leslie were still growing together, and that is what made their relationship so special. How do you feel when you think about Chris and Leslie? Do you feel comfortable and warm? Is the thought of them pleasing to you? If you are not in a relationship like theirs, would you like to be? Would you like to get to know them? Would you still feel the same way if Chris were black and Leslie were white? If Leslie were black and Chris were yellow, would the thought of them still be pleasing? Would you still want to get to know them if Chris and Leslie were both women? What if they were both men? Every spiritual partner is different. One struggles not to see himself as better than other people. Another struggles not to see other people as better than herself. One is learning how to say what he needs. Another is trying not to overpower friends. One needs to learn how to listen. Another needs to learn how to speak. No matter how different spiritual partners are, they are all learning how to align their personalities with their souls. That is why they are together. They want to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life. When you look at spiritual partners, do you see these things? Do you see how difficult their challenges are? Do you admire what they are doing and appreciate how they are trying to do it? If you see anything else, your attention has been distracted by something that all of us have. Earth suits. Gerald's apron was dusted with white flour. Some of it had gotten on his t-shirt. He wiped his hands on his jeans, smiled at me, and took the money I handed him. In the glass case between us were donuts and eclairs. Some of them were covered with chocolate, some with glazed sugar, and some plain. These and ice cream were all that the small bakery sold. In the afternoon, students came after school, and, in the morning, older people drank coffee in the vinyl booths and read newspapers. I came to this bakery often to ship packages, a service which Gerald also provided. Over the years, we had come to recognize each other. During that time, Gerald's appearance never changed. He always had long brown hair and wore jeans, a t-shirt, and an apron. One day, I heard a knock on my door. It was Gerald. But his appearance had changed completely. He was wearing a fashionable suit, and his hair was short. He looked like a prosperous businessman. As I admired his new appearance, he handed me his card. "I came to tell you about my new business," he said, with warmth and authority. "I am an investment broker. This is my new office," he continued, pointing to the address on the card. "If I can help you with your investments, please let me know." He appeared to be a perfect person to discuss investments with. If I had not known him as he was at the bakery, I would not have suspected that he had ever done anything except help people become wealthy through investing their money. The baker, the modest young man in jeans and an apron, and the investment broker, the prosperous young man in the business suit, were both Gerald. He had begun a new life, and his clothing had changed accordingly. I knew that his experiences would change dramatically, too, and I marveled to realize that he was still the same young man. I am happy that I knew Gerald when he owned a bakery, and later when he became an investment broker. If I had known him only when he was a baker, or only when he sold investments, I might not have appreciated how diverse his experiences were. I might have thought of him as a baker or an investment broker and never realized that he was both and more. Gerald changed his clothing when he wanted to have different experiences. Souls do that too. Sometimes they are female. Other times they are male. Those times are lifetimes. Sometimes they are black. Other times they are white, yellow, or brown. Sometimes they have families, and sometimes they organize political movements. Changing clothes is not new to souls. Your soul has done it often. It has also had the many experiences that come with different kinds of clothing. When you look at yourself as a black male or a white female, you are only seeing some clothes. This is how most people see themselves. They think of themselves as men, women, black, yellow, fathers or mothers, or any of the many ways that souls can dress. This is a five-sensory perception. When you begin to know that you are more than a body with some thoughts and feelings, you are becoming multisensory. Then you look at yourself as a soul, and not just as a brown female or white male. You see all of those things, your race, sex, height, hair color, culture, as clothes that your soul is wearing. These are the clothes that your soul chose when it created you. You are not your clothes. You are your soul. What you can see with your five senses are not your friends. They are only the clothes that your friends are wearing. Your friends are souls, too. Her black body, or his yellow body, is clothing. Do you like or dislike someone because of the clothes that he or she is wearing? That is what you do when you do not like someone because of the color of his skin, or because she is a female, or Catholic, or Vietnamese, or an athlete, or poor, or wealthy, or any of the ways that souls choose to dress. A yellow, Thai, Buddhist mother is a suit. A white, German, Jewish father is also a suit. So is a brown, Brazilian, Catholic rancher. They are earth suits. Once you make a friend, it doesn't matter what clothes he or she wears. A friend is a friend. This is how souls see souls. They are friends. The clothes that they wear are not important, just like the clothes that Gerald wore when he stopped being a baker and became an investment broker were not important. He was still Gerald. He wanted to have some new experiences, so he put on some new clothes. Your soul has done that many times. You have been a mother and a father, a city dweller and a nomad. You have been strong and weak. You have been quick-witted and slow. You have lived violent lives and peaceful lives. You have been kind and you have been cruel. You have been black, white, yellow, and red. Each of these was an earth suit, like the one you are wearing now. Each was carefully chosen by your soul. It wouldn't have worked for Gerald to wear a business suit while he was baking pastry, or to wear t-shirts while he was selling investments. Souls see one another as souls who are wearing different earth suits, the same way that I saw Gerald wearing the clothing of a baker at one time and the clothing of a business person the next. Souls are always happy to see each other again. They are happy to see what clothing each is wearing also, but that is not important to them. Being together is important to them. Learning how to create harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life together is important to them. As you become multisensory, you begin to see your friends that way, too. You even begin to see your enemies that way. This is very different from the way that most people look at their friends and enemies. It is also the beginning of some very exciting things. Thank you. Active kindness. No one knows where the lightning struck. By the time crews could reach the area, it was surrounded by hundreds of charred acres. If it were not for the valiant effort of the firefighters, perhaps thousands would have burned. What was once a great forest was now a wasteland. Blackened trunks emerged from a moonscape of lifeless soil. It would be generations before the shade returned. In the meantime, the sun shone relentlessly through the thinning smoke. The smell of charcoal filled the air, and the ground was still hot. Unnoticed through all of this were the tiny seeds that lay scattered on the ashen soil. In them, another forest lay waiting, making itself ready to replace the old. Thousands of older trees had given themselves to the fire. Thousands more were now ready to grow. In slow motion, so slow that none of us can see it, a picture is unfolding. All that we notice is the fire. It is awesome. It cannot be overlooked. Roaring flames leaping 100 feet into the air. Billows of dense, gray smoke float over thousands of acres, obscuring the horizon. It is over and done with in a few days. The picture that we cannot see is unfolding much more slowly. The fire is a part of that picture, but it is not all of it. To see the rest, we would have to live for hundreds of years. We would have to see the fire before this one. No trace of that fire remained by the time the lightning struck again. An ocean of green stretched from ridge to ridge. That ocean grew out of blackened trunks, just as the new ocean of green will now grow. Without the fire, seeds would not have burst forth. Without the seeds, new trees would not grow. Without new trees, the forest would decay. Is the forest that is waiting to grow different from the forest that just burned? They are the same. They are all the same forest, the trees that burned and the trees that will grow because of the fire, and the trees that grew because of fires that no one can remember. Today we try to stop forest fires because people have homes in forests and because cutting trees is a big business. Fires do not threaten the forest. The forests need fires, and they happen naturally. Some people say that lightning strikes are accidents. If you look at all of nature, the lightning strikes don't look that way. From the point of view of nature, everything happens at just the right time. If you look carefully, the rain falling on dry ground is just what the plants need to grow. The plants and the rain are parts of the same picture. If you look only at the plants, or you look only at the rain, you don't see the whole picture. That is like seeing only the fire. Even one animal eating another is part of a larger picture. Nature always provides what is needed when it is needed. Always providing what is needed when it is needed is active kindness. We don't think of nature as being kind, but it is. If we see the whole picture, we can see that nature is always kind. Sometimes we don't think of the universe as being kind either, but it is. If we see only a selfish person or someone suffering, we see only part of a larger picture. If we could see the whole picture, we would be amazed at how compassionate the universe is. We can't ever see the whole picture, but one thing is certain. It contains other people. One other thing is certain. It also contains us. So the first step in seeing more of the picture is to start seeing ourselves and others clearly. That is where active kindness begins. People who have hurt a lot in their lives are often kind. They know what it is to suffer, and they don't want to cause anyone else to suffer. They don't harm life, and so we say that they are kind. Active kindness is more than this. Active kindness takes strength and clarity. Sometimes it requires speaking when it is difficult to speak. Sometimes it requires not speaking when you want to. Sometimes it means being brave enough to act, and at other times it means being brave enough not to act. Active kindness is being appropriate. That is how souls relate to souls. They see more than earth suits. Do you think that you do not deserve to be loved? That is your earth suit talking. If you only see from that perspective, you can never be appropriate. Your heart will always tell you that you deserve to love and to be loved, that you are beautiful, and that you have a right to be on this earth. Do you think that you are more important than other people? If you only see from that perspective, you can never be appropriate either. Your heart will always tell you that everyone is important. It will tell you that no one is more important than you, and that no one is less important than you either. When you see only earth suits, you see only a small part of a larger picture. When you see yourself and others as great souls in the earth school, you see a lot more of it. Then you can act the way that your soul wants to act, and say what your soul wants to say. Then what you say and do will always be appropriate. It will always be just what is needed, just when it is needed. That is active kindness. It is also authentic power. Reaching out. The two skaters moved as one. One was male, the other female. One wore black, the other white. The blades of their skates flashed in the lights that followed them over the ice. Music filled the arena. Where it went, they went. After a while, I couldn't tell whether the music was moving them or they were making the music when they moved. The music, lights, ice, skaters, and all of us merged. I could feel their danger. Every movement was intricate. Each of them required perfect timing. Each would have been difficult on a dance floor. The skaters performed them all at high speed, first with one skater moving backward, then the other, then both backward, then both forward. As they came toward my part of the arena again, they separated. She moved to her right and he to his left. The tempo of the music rose toward a crescendo. Suddenly they veered toward each other very fast. Her arms reached out to him, and he grasped them. In an instant, her body lifted off the ice. With her legs perfectly together, she became a white crane taking flight before our eyes. High over her partner's head she soared, held tightly in his strong hands. Her skates returned to the ice as gracefully as they left.